Thanks everyone who agreed to read. Thank you for being of service. Today's meeting topic is friendships in recovery, and we have Rochelle, who's here to share her experience, strength, and hope, and I will turn it over to you. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm Rochelle. I'm an addict. Hi. First of all, I want to thank the convention committee for asking me to share. I know how much hard work goes into getting all this together for us, and for the love that's been shown by everyone and the friends that are here and the friends that have... Half of my friends have just left on a bus tour, so they'll be in my next step for. You know, but I've got a topic, friendships in recovery, and I'm nervous. I'm just going to say I'm nervous. I'm nervous because I'm not a public speaker. I'm an addict and a socially awkward one at that. That's really true. But all I can do is share my experience, and my topic's friendships in recovery. And you know, in order for me to share about the quality and the depth of the friendships that I've got in recovery, you know, I have the time as well. I need to sort of share about how my friendships were before I came to recovery as well. And, you know, there was some good ones, you know, there was early ones. I had a friendship with my mum. My mum's an addict. But it was very volatile, you know. There was love, and then there was lots of anger and unpredictability. There was a beautiful friendship with my nan, who was like my safe haven when my mum exploded or was in prison, and that was lovely. But what that taught me is that people who love you and care for you die and leave you, you know. And you know, I progressed into children's homes, where I learned another sort of friendship that was often built on trauma and traumatic experiences and abuse that was occurring in the children's homes. And so, you know, I had special bonds with people because we were going through some horrific stuff together. And once again, what that taught me, you know, I remember getting to an age when I was about 12, and I decided that everyone that I loved or cared for or put any trust in either let me down, was abusive in some way, or they died. And I remember sort of consciously making a last-ditch attempt to form a friendship with a girl in a children's home where there was particularly grim stuff happening repeatedly in these homes. And we had a real bond, you know. And we were given drugs. It was probably my first, other than what I saw my mum take at home, my first introduction to drugs was in those children's homes, and they were given to us to help us to comply with being taken out of our rooms at nights. And it was a bargaining tool. You know, if you did as you were told and you were obedient, you would be given the substances. And my friend, Sasha, who I miss dearly to this day, you know, she saved hers up and she took her own life. And you know, I remember being a 14-year-old girl in a bathroom in a children's home, desperately trying to save my friend. And, you know, I'd seen it on the films. They pump on the chest, they breathe into the mouth, and she died. I just saw her drift away before me. And that had a profound effect on me. Because not only did I decide that was it, you know, I was not going to put any sort of trust into a human being again. They just were going to leave me and let me down. But, you know, it also made me very angry, extra angry at the world. And just, you know, I made a conscious decision that day that actually from then on in, it was me on my own. You know, I didn't have a God then. You know, if there was any mention of God, I was very angry because I didn't see a God in my world. I just saw quite a lot of cruelty. So, yeah, my friend had a real impact on me that, and that lasted for for many years. You know, I went out onto the streets. I did all the, like a lot of care kids do, you know, out onto the streets. I had no coping with life skills ever taught to me. So I went out and was homeless. And again, I had different friendships out there. They were friendships that were built on, I need you, you need me, what can I get from you, you get from me. You know, I'd learned to defend myself at quite a young age because I had to. Because, you see, real Rochelle, little Rochelle, is a gentle, sensitive, caring kid, or she was, with a, you know, childlike naivety, who actually was not equipped to be living in the hostile world in which I was born, and I had to harden up really quickly. But inside, little Rochelle was always still there, out on the streets, you know. I formed further friendships there, if that's what you want to call them, you know, but also learned a new level of degradation out there. And worthlessness, you know, I had next to no self-esteem. I woke up one night with a couple of men on the way home from the pub just urinating on my sleeping bag, and I remember that clearly because I remember thinking, you can't help me feel any more worthless than I already feel, and there you are, weeing on me, you know. So I remember just building this hatred towards humans, and my world got smaller and smaller and lonelier, you know. And then I thought my heroes came along after a while, you know, some quite serious, organized criminals. I would have told you when I first came into recovery that they spotted me, and because I was so brave and loyal and tough and all this crap, that's why they picked me. Actually, I've done a bit of work on myself, and I know that I was basically groomed by them because I had this unquestionable loyalty to all the wrong people. I had too much bottle, too much courage, not enough brains. So I was a perfect candidate for these guys to recruit. And then I was immersed into a world where I went willingly because I just always wanted to belong. And I felt like I belonged in this particular gang, you know, and because I'd grown up in a mixed-race family. I wasn't white enough, I wasn't black enough. I lived in areas where I had the wrong accent, you know, and these people just made me feel like I belonged, but I quickly learned that I didn't belong with them because once I stopped, in fact, you didn't even have to make these people mad for them to turn on you. And the levels of violence and horrors that I saw and that were done to me, at the hands of these people, just hardened me and made me even more lonely again. So that was, you know, further friendships up in smoke. And years of drug use continued. And, you know, I brought children into the world, and with the intention that if I could just have children, then I'd have someone that I could love unconditionally and that everything was going to be okay. And I don't know, there's plenty of parents in this room, I'm sure. I learned the hard way that the greatest love I've ever known, which is the love for my children, wasn't enough to stop me using. You know, I used a variety of things. It really doesn't matter now. I did used to think it mattered what I took. It doesn't matter, but I used a variety of things to turn off the pain. You know, I didn't use because I liked the taste or the flavour. I used because something happened to me when I put a substance in my body where it stopped vulnerable, sensitive, shy, in pain, rage, and it made life bearable, you know. And yeah, so I just used a variety of stuff, and I couldn't stop once my children came along, you know. And I had this love like I've never known for them. And there was a point when, you know, I tried to get my life together at times, and I took up boxing. Boxing was a sport that I naturally became good at because I was very used to being punched in the face at this point in life, and I was quite good at punching people in the face, you know. And you know, I sort of semi-tried to get my life together, and I just remember the day that my using really turned, you know, it drastically turned, was beautiful children and bringing them up, doing my best to be as clean as I could be, which was just use one relatively harmless substance, you know, in my head. My daughter was raped when she was 6 years old, and I remember the anger that consumed me at that point was like nothing I've ever felt. You know, I could deal with everything that life had thrown at me, but to have these beautiful children and then see life and monsters get their hands on my children was something that took my using to a whole new level of self-destruct, really. Total self-destruction, you know. And it says in our cards at the end of the we do recover, you know, at the end of the road when, you know, you can't live with or without drugs. And the end of my road looked like that. You know, I was injecting a variety of stuff into the last vein in my neck. I was living in a house at animal level with my two children who had dragged up at this point. You know, they'd been dragged to jail and back to visit me and seen me dragged off at gunpoint and beaten up and all that stuff that kids should never, ever have to witness. I just remember thinking, surely I can stop using, surely. You know, I've overcome so much in life. Why can I not just stop? You know, and I had no idea what I was up against, you know, and thankfully came into recovery where I went to a detox centre where H&I was, the message was carried to me via H&I, and I learned about the 12 steps and I didn't have anything else to lose, you know, because those substances that I was putting into my neck at the end of my using weren't stopping the pain. But when I came in, you know, I looked around and I looked around at the friendships that I saw that were going on in recovery and people genuinely happy to see each other, hugging each other. They had a light in their eyes. They looked alive. I was dead, dead behind the eyes. You know, I was just a broken, angry, lonely woman. And I saw something that you lot had and I really desperately wanted it. And I did all that stuff, you know, when my disease separated me from you lot in any way that it could, you know, I decided that you all must be using something, just a little something, because you all looked so happy, you know. You all had teeth. I couldn't understand how you had teeth, because I had three, you know. You looked clean and fresh, like the people that I'm looking out at now, you know, and I just separated myself, but I stuck around because I had nowhere else left to go and the drugs had stopped working, so there was no point in going back to them. I stuck around and I threw myself into this stuff, you know, with the same passion that I threw myself into using with. There were, you know, there was a point When my daughter had been raped, where I tried to kill the man who raped my daughter, and I ended up in prison looking at some serious jail time. And I made a conscious decision at that point, looking at 13 years at least behind bars, that I was going to destroy myself, you know, one drug at a time. And so when I came in here and I saw what you lot had, this magic and this light in your eyes, and you were having belly laughs. I mean, I'd forgotten what a belly laugh was. I don't even remember when I'd last had one. I wanted it. I desperately wanted what you had. So I used the same dogged determination that had helped me to survive that hellish existence. I used that, you know, to shut up and listen to what was going on in these rooms. And I was, you know, I used my street skills. I learned who was just talking a lot of nonsense and who seemed to be living it. I learned about spiritual principles and step work. I had some good role models, some good early friendships, people who told me not to mess about with this stuff, not to take this program, you know, with a pinch of salt. They said, did you use half-heartedly, Rochelle? I said, no. They said, well, you need to give the same to your recovery, you know, and that's what I've done. You know, I've thrown myself into it. I threw myself into step work. And I think the first relationship that I got, friendship in recovery, was that with my sponsor. They told me I had to get a female sponsor. I know that's not the way everywhere, but where I'm from in my area, it was suggested that I got a female sponsor. Now, don't forget, when I came in here, I hated humans. And I was quite willing to tell you. I was quite vocal about it, you know. I hated God. I was rude about him. If any of you mention that, you know, I spewed venom at people for talking about God, because I had not seen a God in the 38 years before I got here. What I know now is God had me every single step of the way. God had me when I was at gunpoint, when I was overdosing. God had me all those times there was attempts made on my life, all the times I made attempts on my life. God had me throughout. In every jail cell, behind every skip that I slept, he had me in the darkest situations, you know. But I wasn't up for listening to God, but I begrudgingly took the suggestion that I get a female sponsor. I didn't like women at all. I had no... I was quite angry towards you. If you smiled at me, I'd growl at you. You know, I was still fresh out of jail, so I was like, you know, and angry. I didn't like men neither. I couldn't stand you lot neither. I hated you all. The only thing I had any love for when I got here was dogs. I love dogs, you know? You feed anyone water a dog, it will die for you. But I got the sponsor, you know. I was told to just do the opposite to what I wanted to do. I got this female sponsor, and it's the same sponsor I have now, 14 and a half years later, the world's most patient woman, trust me. Because I'm one of those addicts, very sort of childlike, anti-authority, grew up in jail and institutions, so you tell me to go left and I'm going right, even if I desperately want to go left, you know. And she's just met me with unconditional love. You see, I wanted her to meet me with violence. I can deal with that. Abuse, I can deal with that, you know. But she just kept meeting me with love. And I've tested her so many times and I've tried to push her away. I was thinking at some point she's going to betray my trust, this woman. At some point she's going to let me down. Of course she will. Humans always let you down. And she's just kept meeting me with love. The harder I've tried to push that woman away, the more that she's loved me, and she's been through some really dark times with me and shared. She cried when I told her the disgusting things that I'd done to other people and that they'd done to me, and she loved me anyway. And I'd never experienced that unconditional love from anybody, ever. You know, and as a result of having this friendship with her, my first and most precious friendship, I then started to get a sort of relationship and a friendship with myself, because as a result of doing the step work with her, a step at a time, I threw myself into that step work. I'm a great believer in step work. I'm a great believer that I can't sit close to Glenn there and get his recovery. You know, I can't. I need to work at it, and I need to look at myself. And I heard lots of horror stories. Oh, it's really bad, that step work. Don't do that. Oh, step four, I used to think, really? Did you use like I use? Because that was frightening. You know, getting up every day, having to do that degrading shit, that was frightening. You know, surely this step work can't be that bad. And sometimes it's a bit unpleasant, and sometimes I wince at some of the stuff that I remember. But the freedom that comes from the other side of it is so much more important. And I started to thaw out as a result of working through the steps and started to put down the boxes of guilt and shame and remorse and all that sadness and anger, you know. I've thawed out as a result of doing this stuff. And eventually, you know, I got the stuff. People said to me, you know, if you do this stuff, Rochelle, you'll get life beyond your wildest dreams. And I used to think, oh, piss off. Do you know, like, I'm really trying not to swear, by the way. It's usually much worse. You know, but I didn't believe them, you know, the NA cliches, you know. And, you know, I started to get educated in this fellowship. You know, I was old when I got here. I'm even older now. But, you know, I was like almost 40 and a student with all these kids who knew how to use a computer and a laptop. And the only thing I needed to do was steal one. I had no idea how to work one. You know, I educated myself. I started to build a friendship with my children, my broken, damaged children, you know. That's an ongoing thing, you know, I'll talk about a little bit more in a while, but I started to get semi-friendships with you lot, and what I mean by that is it's become apparent to me in the later years that what I did was I let you in a little bit. So I had Lisa, that's my beautiful sponsor, and I started to build a relationship with God, which is getting, you know, stronger a day at a time if I connect with him or her, you know. And but I only sort of let people in a little bit. And when I looked at that, I was reading The Living Clean and The Friendships in Recovery, and I looked at why that was the hardest thing to do. And it's good that I got this topic, because Friendships in Recovery has been the hardest thing for me. And it's because that inbuilt fear, that monstrous fear of these people are going to let you down at some point, you know. And as a result of recovery, I've thawed out. I've gone back to That gentle, kind, sensitive rage with no medication, no drugs to numb me. And so I felt even more vulnerable in this fellowship because all the hard exterior was dropped. I was letting you lot see me. You know, so the friendships have been really hard. So I started to let people in, but only a little bit, just a little bit. And especially the women, you know, they said, get around the women, they'll tell you about yourself. So actually what I did without realizing it, I've only learned this in the later years, is I let the women be my friends. I was like, okay, I'm your friends. I'll give you a hug. If you're crying, I'm going to look after you. I'll do anything for you. But don't you dare tell me about me. Not if you know what's good for you. You know, and I used it. It was like a subtle intimidation almost that I would never have admitted to, but I kind of did, you know. And that was a lonely place to be because really all I was doing was trying to control people. So other than God, who doesn't actually have a direct line to me and my sponsor, no one could tell me about me. You know, I've got sponsees. I want to share about my sponsees. What a privilege, right? I did what a lot of us do. I got sponsees and thought, shit, I can't help these girls. I'm only just helping myself. But I got these amazing sponsees, a whole variety of them. You know, I had a wonderful young girl. She came from a similar background to me of sort of trafficking and grooming and violence and abuse. And she couldn't read, she couldn't write. And to watch this young woman grow, you know, she used to bring her step work to me in a squiggles that she understood. And we'd sit and share. And it was such a privilege for her to open up and share her deepest, darkest secrets with me that I was so humbled and sat and cried with her as my sponsor had cried with me. And the love that I found for that girl and my other sponsors was incredible, you know. And I've watched her go on, you know, through living and applying this stuff given in this program, to get a master's degree and stand there. I went to see her with a cap and gown, bawling. She calls me mum, you know, just bawling. It was so emotional. I had I've had many sponsors, but the couple that really stand out, I had one lady. She came to me, she was 60 when she came to me. I was like, why is she asking me to sponsor? Like, what do we have in common? And you know, we had a lot in common. She had a son who was using, you know, very hectically. Now my son uses very chaotically too. So we bonded on this, the fear as a parent when you're trying to stay in recovery and you're watching your kid kill themselves on drugs a day at a time and living a violent and destructive lifestyle. And we bonded, me and this beautiful girl, and she got years in. And we always used to share about the fear, the total fear. You know, I've had a couple of knocks on the door by the police from my son to escort me personally to hospital because my son's been stabbed again or hit with a hammer or hit with a van and he's on life support. And I know what fear is. And so me and my sponsee, we bonded, you know, because we lived in fear, even with a program and spiritual principles. And a few weeks ago, she got her knock on the door. You know, she got the knock on the door that we dread. And I've watched this woman, this amazing woman, who, you know, I remember her coming in broken. I've watched her stay clean, you know, and bury her son, you know, and grieve with dignity. I have other friends here today who've done the same thing. And these people inspire the shit out of me. I mean, that to me is the epitome of recovery, that you can hold on tight, you know, to the friendships that we have in recovery when you've lost the most important thing. You know, so the friendships that I've got here are, you know, just beyond measure. You know, I've built up friendships with my children. My mum, thanks, Nikki, love. My mum always said my eyes were too close to my bladder. You know, my children, they're damaged, both of them. My son, when I was like 8 years clean, my son was hit by a van. He lives the life like, you know, he thinks he's a gangster, just like his mum did. And I was his role model, for God's sake. What did I expect the kid to grow up like? You know, and I remember him being hit by this van. I remember the police coming and knocking on my door, you know, and taking me to the hospital. I remember looking through the window in the hospital. I can see them doing CPR on this kid. I'm not thinking I know who that is. And then I saw the sheet drop off his leg, and that was the tattoo that was my son's leg. And I was like, oh, shit, that's my son. What am I going to do? It was unthinkable, you know. And I remember being sat in intensive care, and he's all wired up on life support, feeling so alone for a moment. And my daughter's across the other side of the bed, and she's saying, oh, no, Mum, what am I going to do? You know, I'm going to lose you both. My brother's there. He's going to die. They're going to turn the machine off, and you're going to use. I said to her, no, sweetheart, I'm in the no matter what club. Your brother is proud of me, you know. He's proud of me. People used to go past him and say, oh, you know, your mum, you know, the junkie, and he's got to watch me grow. You know, as a result of being in this fellowship and getting my conviction spent and living the life that Narcotics Anonymous has taught me, I became a firefighter. And I share that because my children have such pride that I used to be that, you know, injecting animal level junkie that was their mother, and now I put my uniform on and go out and serve my community as a firefighter. That gives them pride, you know. But my daughter was like, you know, you're going to use and he's going to die. And I said I wouldn't. And you know, I share this because, you know, the love of this fellowship, the friendships that I'd got in this fellowship were booming through the wall of that hospital. They held me in the darkest times. You know, my son, he survived, you know, and he's recovered. He's learned to walk and talk again. He's clearly brain damaged. I say unfortunately, which sounds very ungrateful when people live through some stuff, right? I say unfortunately, he's recovered enough to remember that he thinks he's a gangster still. So now my brain damaged kid is running around with drugs in his pocket that he's selling, swimming with the sharks with his brain damage and his slurred speech. And I really know what fucking powerless means. I really do. You know, but the friendships that are built in here and the parents that are going through similar, that have kids out there using, are what hold me. Because I've always found this with this fellowship. It's you lot that show me how to do things when I just simply can't do them, you know. My mum's coming to recovery, which is a real gift. My mum got a year clean not long ago. You know, and as a kid that grew up away from her in care and very angry towards it, it's great. She had periods of clean time before that. Well, no, she had periods of abstinence before that. So she was basically batshit crazy and just not using. But now she's in recovery and doing some step work. And, you know, so both my children have actually been to NA. So, you know, the ripple effects of this stuff is magic. How I will always do service for NA because I will always sit here and overcome my nerves or clean the dishes or do whatever for NA. Because how can I thank a fellowship that has got my mum in the middle of its love and its friendship that's helped me or helps me a day at a time, you know, transform my life, that's had its doors open and wrapped itself with love around my children. You know, the people from this fellowship came into hospital when I had to push my son round and feed him with a spoon and change his nappies. And they took him out for walks. They gave me breaks. You know, they talked about recovery to him. You know, I can't ever pay. These are the friendships that I always wished to have and dreamed to have that I now, you know, have in recovery. And I want to share about, you know, the deeper levels of friendship that I've got recently and the reason why I've got a deeper level of friendship and I've fully let people in, because I was sharing with you earlier how I sort of only partially ever let you in. And it was all fear-based, totally scared that, you know, they say, don't they, oh, get a suit if you come into NA. That scared me as well. I mean, we're a high-risk fellowship, right? We fall like flies. You're not, you know, I'm... It's such a gentle, so I attach myself to people. I'm like, oh, you're my friend. I like you, you know. And then people go out and use and die. And so I get scared to make friendships in here because then I'm caring that you're going to look after your recovery as well because I want you to, because if you use, then you're going to leave me as well, you know. And sometimes I can be a bit forceful and try not to ram recovery down people's throats and be like, stop messing about. You'll die. But it's out of love, you know. It's out of love because I've seen what happens. I've lived what happens when this disease subtly creeps in. I got to 9¾ years clean, and I got really ill. And you know, for my job as a firefighter, I have to stay quite fit. And when I came into recovery, I'd started boxing again as well. So my fitness was reasonably good, you know, for my job and everything. I got really ill a few years back, and was rushed into hospital, all blue, gasping for breath. It was like someone had filled my lungs up with water, and I was scared. And I was given prescription drugs. Now, I'm not one of those NA doctors people need medication in the fellowship. And I think if it's used responsibly and honestly and with integrity and you need it, then you're clean. You know, I've heard all sorts of messages different from that. But my belief is we need medication if we need it, yeah? So I took this medication because I was in excruciating pain. Then I left the hospital with it. Handed my morphine in. I think my ego must have been all over that. I handed it in at the same chemist they used to pick up a certain substitute from. Look how well I am, you know. And I remember taking these tablets, and I remember my sponsor saying to me at one point, "Rochelle, do you think that is still codeine pain?" And I said, "Yeah, so who are you?" Because when I last checked, you were my sponsor, not my doctor. Now, I should have known then that my attitude was stinking, because this is a woman, like I've just told you, who's loved me unconditionally, and that was my reply to her. That's how disrespectful I was. But I went away and thought about it and minced on it, and I was taking 2-4 times a day, like it says on the packet. So my disease and my head is like, no, of course I'm using it responsibly. Irresponsibility is taking the packet and hanging off the settee, you know? But I stopped taking it, started taking a different paracetamol, but it was begrudgingly. And I didn't know at this point, I've only learned these lessons with hindsight, but by now my disease is out of its cage that I've carefully wrapped it in for almost 10 years. It's alive and kicking, but I don't know it. I'm the very last person to know it. And because all my friendships with you lot were on a superficial level, nobody was really close enough to me to tell me, only my sponsor, who I didn't want to listen to because I was ill, you know. And I skipped off to Barbados. I mean, me to Barbados, right, to the Barbados Convention. I'm the sort of girl who used to have to go in and out the country for people, usually take my children as some sort of decoy, you know, with me, looking like I'd been dug up from the local cemetery. So I don't know why I thought I was sort of incognito, but I used to get pulled all the time, taken to customs, taken for x-ray, all that stuff, cavity searches. And I go to Barbados with my suitcase and my passport, and I'm clean in my head, I'm clean, with my sponsor to this convention, and I'm sat on this beach in Barbados, and it's like paradise, right? This white sand and palm trees and this crystal blue sea, and I'm like, how did I get here? I used to live behind a skip. How did I get here? This is amazing, right? There was no burnt children. I see some horrific things in my job, really, really horrific things. There was no burnt children, mangled people in car crashes. I wasn't there with my brain-damaged son, who it's quite torturous to be around sometimes and incredibly painful. I was in paradise, but I had my disease with me, and I didn't know, and this disease was out. And I saw this man, because obviously there was all us lot, but there was a lot of normals at the convention too in the hotel. I saw this man walk off down to the beach with his wife. I spotted his glass of brandy, and all I can tell you is that my arm went out as if it wasn't even my arm. It picked up his brandy like I was like on a bit of a Robin thing. I was like, watched him go, and then I drank it. And as the brandy went down, there was no like, one is too many, a thousand is never enough, Rochelle. If you drink that, you're going to stick needles in your neck again. You're going to lose everything you've built over these 10 years. There was none of that. I know now in hindsight, because hindsight's a wonderful thing, that I had had a spiritual decay that had taken place from the very minute that I started taking that prescription drugs, you know, without vigilance, from the very minute I underestimated the power of them, and I clearly overestimated the power of my almost 10 years clean. I'd been going through a spiritual decay, and I'd never let any of you lot in enough to realise that. So I relapsed, you know, and that was 10 years almost. A week off at this point I was, poof, gone. right? And so I need to tell you, you know, in my last bit of time, what I do differently now. You know, friendships in recovery is such a perfect topic for me because now, wow, I have some friendships because now I was desperate to let you let in. I knew, I didn't see any of this at the time, but hindsight's a wonderful teacher. And I'd seen that I'd never really let any of you close enough, you know. And I know that my life depends on letting you lot see me exactly as I am, letting you lot tell me when I need telling, even though I won't like it. If I don't like it, you're probably right, you know. And letting you lot see me in all my vulnerability. You know, I used to sit in meetings, and because there wasn't many women with clean time in my area, I would want to sit there and say, I actually want to drive my car off a bridge today. I want to die. I'm miserable. My brain damaged son's doing my head in. I've just pulled a dead kid out of a building. I'm really traumatized. I've had enough. But a newcomer would come in and I'd go, oh, I need to carry a message. I need to carry a message. So I never was telling anyone what was really going on for me. Now I don't care. What clean time I gather in this subject, I need to share what honestly goes on for me a day at a time, because if I don't, I'll die. I'll be the still suffering addict sat in this room totally alone in my own pain. You know, and I believe a message is that no matter how I turn up and in what condition at a meeting, the message is that I've turned up clean, whether I cry through the meeting. So I'll let you lot in now. I have some really amazing friendships with women, with men, with friends that have got on a bus to go on a tour, that are going in my next step for, with friends that I've seen that I haven't seen since Brazil, and just, you know, and new friends. I'm looking out on it. When I was here, I was sat and I was nervous, really bloody nervous, and I was looking out and I was thinking, oh, I know a few, but I don't know many of them, and you're my future friends, you know, because I love seeing all your fresh, clean faces, because I'm looking at sisters and mothers and daughters and sons and brothers, and I really bloody love this fellowship. I love the transformation, so, you know, I know that I'm not alone here. I've been alone my whole life. It was lonely out there, trying to be someone that wasn't me, living against all my morals and consciences, because the drugs never numb that stuff. I always knew I was not my true self. And now, you know, the relationship with God just for today is strong. The relationship with you lot is strong, you know, and... You know, I've learned to be a woman with boundaries, and I make sure that Big Rach, Big Rochelle today looks after that little Rochelle that no one was ever around to look after, you know, and if I get lost, I lean on my friendships in recovery to show me the way home, because, you know, I'll end on this. This is what we do. I believe we're all coming here and we're totally lost, and the people in here, we have a map, and we're like, do you want us to show you the way home? Here, I've got the map. Just follow me, you know, so... Thank you lot for helping me stay clean another day. I can actually enjoy the convention now because the nerves have gone. And lots of love to you all. Thank you.